God damn it, you accursed. Welcome to the pod. David Hurley here. And if I look at the Zoom squares on my screen, I can see we've got Scott Reed over there and Corey Tonike over there. But cripes, there is no Zoom square for Jordan this week. Fellas, she's traded us in for camping and s'mores and spending quality time with her family before the school year starts. Go figure. What's with these kids anyway?
No kidding. My kids are home today. I just went upstairs and my son is sitting in a bathrobe watching a raging bull. So I'm the gold medal winner at the Shit Dad Olympics. So you should try that.
Yeah, she says she's going to be back next week. I think we'll have to start doing these things in a tent or something somewhere. Anyway, all right, here's the show today. We'll jump all over last week's developments in the Greenbelt story, including the Premier's presser, new federal polls widening the gap between the Conservatives and Liberals, and more talk about Trudeau as a liability. We'll talk about that. Our cursed clipping is from Christian Past Lang at cbc.ca. 900,000 international students are coming to Canada this year, a record number, and Minister Miller has concerns about the integrity of our immigration system. After all of that, the great Gordon Pinsent calls for our Hey Yous. Scott, Corey, who's going to bolster the left flank of this pod today? You both have good credentials.
For me. It'll be me all the way. I promise.
Absolutely.
Jordan, that I will represent the NDP very capably today. I hope she's happy with my performance. We'll get feedback next week, I'm sure.
I think we could split it up, though. I think that Scott could do the identity cultural politics side of the NDP, because he's right in there with that. Yeah. And you could do the working class, rural roots, social democratic NDP.
That's what I was going to go for. And and if I do it well, I'll be more popular with my extended family, because many of them come from that side of the ledger, and I love them for it. So we'll try to make my family happy here.
I'm sorry. The whole thing already sounds like I'm being discriminated against, so I'll be filing a complaint with the Ontario Human Rights Commission.
Ha! This was a microaggression.
It was. I thought verging on macro.
Well, get ready. There's some macro ones coming at you later.
All right. Let's quit laughing, because we got to talk about the federal polls. And it's no fucking laughing matter. So what we saw this past week was another abacus and a couple of other polls all showing, the Liberals somewhere between 10 and 13 points down, and tied in Atlantic Canada, losing by 10 points in the GTHA, losing by 20 points in British Columbia, and third. It's all pretty disastrous. Late in a late term government, this is the kind of numbers you expect to see, but then you also expect a certain result at the end of the day. So do the Liberals have to do something very different to get back into the game? I haven't noticed coming out of the retreat that they seem to be showing themselves to be different, that they had a cold shower there and they came out of there and they said, we've got to have some different ideas. We've got to have some different comms approaches. So Scott, let me start with you. What kind of change do they have to represent now in order to start to stop this momentum? We don't even know where this ends, by the way. 26% for the Liberals, which Coletto showed, is just break glass, pull the emergency lever time.
Yeah. And I always remind people whenever you start to see numbers like this federally or provincially of what you used to say, David, which was if the Liberal Party federally is falling beneath the 30% mark, it's time to gather and to determine what needs to happen, because something needs to happen. And what's so baffling, and we don't know, we're only seeing the outside of the house, we're not seeing the inside, but what appears to be baffling is there's very little indication that Trudeau and the team feel like they need to make any kind of adjustment. And obviously that is incorrect. And it would be a mistake, for example, I think, to assume that, well, we're in tough economic times and these are challenging times and we're an incumbent government. And so what you've got to do is believe in what you're doing as an agenda, as a set of policies, and then just, wait it out and they'll come back. That's not a strategy. And so to my mind, when I look at this, I think they've got to embrace some change. I think they have to start to actually say, here are three things we're focusing on, and we're going to really try to move the needle. Here's how we're going to move the needle. Like, I'd start by setting expectations, but most important of all, I would take one step on a ladder. Like, you know, you're not going to fix everything overnight, and you're probably not going to fix the big thing. So as an example, they need to talk about housing. They've been fitful and uneven in it. I know we're going to talk about immigration and international students in a minute, and that was a partial response, it seemed, and I've got some criticism of that in terms of the housing issue coming out of last week's cabinet retreat. But like, I think they got to be careful about sort of saying, okay, well, we get how big an issue housing is, and we're effectively permitting you politically to make that a referendum on whether or not we deserve to get out of jail. Like, I think they have to set smaller tests for themselves. They have to identify an issue, move the yardsticks on it, and create some success. They need some wins. So I would start looking at, you know, where can we, what's 26 to 31? And how do we peel back 2-3% on that? What issues, what messages would unlock that? Let's like start taking this thing in chunks, in steps. And obviously, I think they, you know, they just can't avoid the need to talk, you know, more fluently, more effectively, more compassionately about economic issues. And so the final thing I would say is this, and I'm going to throw out a big dime here at the end. I think they need Mark Carney. If I were them, I'd say, you know what? We need to bolster our economic bench. And this guy's been hovering around for a long time. Put him in the fucking game. You know, free up a seat. Give the guy a chance. Tell people you care enough about the economy that you're going to take one of the big foreheads of them internationally in the economy. I don't know if he's willing in game, but I would try to throw him in. And if you go, oh, well, you know, you got to think about the politics internally and Freeland and where's that go? And is he finance minister? Like, what? I'd take him in and I'd make him environment minister and say, all right, here's a guy who's talked about net zero, but he's talked about how you can do that using finance and using smart economic paths. Like whatever. But I would put the guy in the game. Show people you're willing to play a card. So I know I said take small steps and that's a big one, but, you know, I just think they got to do something else because what they're doing ain't working and there's no indication that it will start to work.
Well, it would seem more liberals every day are thinking about maybe putting somebody else in, but not in that role, not environment, maybe in the main seat. The grumbling is continuing and it would seem the volume is being turned up. And these polls are only going to make that internal problem and that internal questioning of Trudeau's leadership even more acute, in my view. But I'll be the one of the three of us here this morning is going to say I'm really fucking excited about the polls. I think they're really good. I don't see this as a problem to be solved. I see this as a moment to be celebrated with great vigor.
Ain't that like a liberal? I just assume everyone says crisis is a terrible development.
No, I'm quite pleased about it all. Look,
but put your strategist hat on and help the liberals out here. What do they got to do?
Well, they got to start talking about and doing things for the middle class. Like, you know, this micro, we talked about this last week, but this micro targeting bullshit continues. And like, they come out talking on housing again and this week, and it's all small ball shit for with great amounts of means testing associated with it. Which is great if you're Jagmeet Singh, because you can say, hey, I'm delivering for my base of low-income renters and people who are kind of living on the economic margins. Not that there's anything wrong with doing things for those folks, but you know, we're here to talk about politics, not policy. And the politics of micro-targeting to 10% of the public again and again and again, and leaving 70% of the public left holding an empty cup, is not a good political strategy. And they got elected in 2015 and saying we're going to be the champions of the middle class. I always thought that was a pretty dubious prospect given that you had a nepo baby as a leader, but you know, they pulled it off, but they're not pulling it off now. Like, what they're pulling off right now is a nepo baby leading some left-wing social activists, and what they're leaving behind is the electorate that got them there. They've got to figure out how to start talking about things in a way that connects with the middle class. Now, there's limited things, I think, from an outcomes policy basis that you can do around cost of living and some of these other issues. But you got to at least start talking about the problem with some degree of empathy, and to put yourself as someone standing on the side of the middle class, because right now they're not. They're standing on the side of, you know, maybe an important group of people that need help, but from an electoral perspective, you know, 10% plus, you know, your most hardened supporters gets you to 26, apparently. And 26 is a good way to get thrown out of office, and not just a little bit. Like, you know, we're looking at, you know, potentially Mulroney 88 level numbers here if this slide continues. And that is devastatingly bad for the Liberal Party. So, you know, it's not just a change election. It's a change election with a giant exclamation mark and a fuck you at the end of it right now. That's what they're looking at.
And I don't understand what they're supposed to do on housing, Corey. I don't understand what they're supposed to do, because nothing is going to change substantively in the housing market between now and 2025. So I understand, I'm not talking about policy now. There's probably a million policies they should put in place. But politically, there's not going to be a lot more people with affordable housing, with houses they housing they can afford in 2025 than there are today.
Well, you do have time to see some big things announced in terms of both programs, but also projects. And projects is really, I think, what the more important of the two is. You know, there's a roster of projects that are in the pipeline that were pulled together. And I think your interview with Keysmat got into this on the Hurly Burly, that were financed in a different environment, that were predicated on assumptions on the economic side that are no longer present. And there's ways that the government could close the gap on those projects. And I would be looking to do that so that those people are standing next to you. Now, the challenge with that part of it is it's once again playing to the 10% as opposed to everybody else. But I do think there are things that they could do that they don't want to do, that finance doesn't want to do, like, you know, exempting HST.
That was an idea from Keysmat. I thought that was pretty simple to communicate, pretty easy to do.
But it's one that's been on the table from the provinces. You know, some provinces are already doing it or signaling they're going to do it around the PST portion of the HST. If I were the federal government, I'd be looking at getting in on that action. And we're going to talk about it in a minute, but I think there's a lot of stuff that's, you know, virtually 100% within their realm around immigration. So if you're looking at, we have a shortage of workers and we've got a surplus of sort of irregular border crossers. Why isn't the government getting in the game of making sure that there's housing for those people and have it be federal housing? They have federal lands, they have federal dollars, they have the ability to get their own construction contracts. I would, and you can do this right away, I would start constructing housing for those people. And another group is foreign students. You know, it came, I think, as a shock to me seeing, and I'll maybe should pause on this, but that we've got 900,000 foreign students in the country right now, triple what it was 3 years ago. So, you know, if you're gonna triple the number of foreign students in the market, you better have some fucking housing for them. And you know, like there's a bunch of issues
some,
here.
Some, where so I much think of it doesn't seem in. Like they things were connected, eh, Corey? It just doesn't seem
no,
like.
No, well, but this gets to the competence issue. It's like, you know, you guys have a cabinet. Like, did none of you sit around the table and talk about these things? Do you not go through cabinet committee where you try to look at secondary impacts? Like, this is how every other government functions. And, you know, I'm sure there's an attempt to do that there, but it's not an attempt that results in success on a range of issues, it would appear. And the student issue is just another one.
Rising cost of living. What's a timelier or more fraught topic than that? I mean, we talk a hell of a lot about its political implications on Curse of Politics. On the Hurly Burly, we dive a little deeper into how it affects us and the potential policy solutions that could help. So I'd like to take just a minute here to explore some brand new inflation data I skimmed by last week. It's from the latest Consumer Price Index. Short story, and I hardly need to tell you this because you feel it every day, is pretty much everything is going up. Gas, groceries, energy, borrowing costs, and more, prices increased an average of 3.3% year over year in July. Note, that's just the average. Food and other staples? Much more than that. But within this larger, how much higher can this possibly go inflationary jag? Prices for cellular services, like those from our presenting sponsor TELUS, decreased, that's what I said, decreased, by almost 15% year over year. So that's got to be a blip, right? A moment in time. Nope. The longer term trend over the last 3 years is prices for cellular services are down 33%. So the simple question in the context of constantly escalating cost of living across the board is why, dear Hurlyburlyites, is the price of your cell service de-escalating? The answer isn't so simple, so much so that we'll spend the next few weeks exploring it. But let's start with this. The current market forces at play and government policy that continues to promote investment and innovation, as well as aggressive price competition from TELUS and its facilities-based competitors, is working. Facilities-based carriers like TELUS own, build, operate, and invest in the continued innovation and expansion of a network and its services. There is another model, wholesale wireless resellers, who just parasitically ride the network and resell access to it. They offer a price, but they don't invest, they don't innovate service, and they don't contribute to the greater good. And in other jurisdictions around the world, it has not worked out for consumers. Next week, I'll put some data where my mouth is on that. Stay tuned. Scott, when I talk to liberals, whether they be cabinet ministers or staffers or just activists on the ground, the thing that everybody is clinging to is not that Trudeau's going to pull some rabbit out of his hat and be an amazing campaigner, not that the government's going to turn around and be radically different. What everybody is clinging to is the hope that Canadians will not vote for Pierre Poilievre and that he's some sort of unusual and extreme figure that Canadians will recoil from at the end of the day. I'm increasingly suspicious of this. I don't see any evidence of it in the polling. He's now got them up around 38. One poll showed them at 41. Those are pretty big numbers for the modern Conservative Party to be hitting. And I noticed that Abacus tested their ad and went over extremely well, including with Liberal and NDP voters, softened a lot of animosity among Liberal and NDP voters. And he improved in the last 2 weeks, improved his personal standing by 8 percentage points.
Yeah.
Advertising works.
I did some radio last week and I had David on and he talked a little bit about the focus groups and talked about how the ad played. And it unfortunately reinforced my assumptions, which when I looked at it, I thought this thing's going to work with their target audiences. You talk about the hope that liberals have that they'll be able to disqualify Pierre Poilievre or that he'll disqualify himself. I think that's reflected by a fear on the part of conservatives that that could happen, right? That, you know, well, wait a second, is this guy's edge is too sharp? Is he too alienating to women? The difference is that the conservatives are doing something about it. And it appears that it's effective, right? So they are experimenting with changes in the way he dresses. I don't like all of them, but in the way he dresses and what he says, they've dropped the tag of freedom, you know, Braveheart, and they've moved to common sense, which we know played in Ontario a generation ago. Feels to me like it's kind of tailor-made for our times, to be honest. And I don't think there's a copyright on it. I don't think there's any shame in borrowing it if it's effective. And what's not happening, of course, is that the Liberals haven't spent the past year trying to define Pierre Poilievre, other than, as we've said repeatedly, every now and then when the Prime Minister himself loses his temper at a microphone and says, hey, fuck, is anyone looking at this guy? Like, come on, right? Well, if you feel that way, why haven't you licensed your team to, you know, put $3 million behind an ad campaign that pound the living piss out of them? So there's that. A couple of quick things. You know, Corey raises the point about how liberals are talking and people are still, you know, like and the fear about Trudeau staying. I think there's another fear liberals ought to have when I look at these numbers, and that's that he could leave. Because I look at it and I worry that he'll walk up to the edge of the next election, and as a lot of politicians will do, and particularly incumbent prime ministers, right up to the edge, assuming that he'll be able to magic trick his way out of it and then conclude that it looks bad and bails. Now, I'm hoping that he finds a course correction prior to that. But I think that a great risk for the Liberal Party is that, you know, they stall where they are And then increasingly, he just says, okay, I'm going to pack it in rather than lose my last election. You kind of have two courses. You can follow LeBron Maloney.
You got to pay royalties, Scott. I have trademarked that analysis. It's the Hurley theorem of Canadian politics, which is prime ministers leave when they have concluded they can't win the next election or when they've lost the election, and in no other circumstances. Yeah. And they tend not to conclude that until very late before the day. Mulroney 93, Trudeau 84, you know.
By the time they come to the conclusion that it is truly curtains, it really means that it's over for the party and the opportunity of rejuvenation is effectively nil.
And McGuinty did it well, by the way. I mean, not that the exit was good. I was reminded of sort of a Saigon in 75, but but he left Kathleen a year.
Sufficient time.
He left Kathleen a year to put her own imprint on a government, right? So,
and I'm not advocating that he leave. I mean, I'm still a voice out there that says stay and improve rather than bail and hope, because I don't have a lot of hope for the other prospects. And I don't, let me put it this way. I think that Trudeau, a combination of putting the boots to Poilievre, shifting some of his focus and campaigning effectively, particularly in connecting with Quebecers, still offers them that combination of prescriptions is a better possible outcome for the Liberal Party than what just about any of the other pretenders can conjure. I just don't see them being able to put together the same recipe. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we'll have a race and somebody will blow the living wheels off me. I don't know.
So I posted some numbers on LinkedIn this weekend just to provide some context for these polling numbers. There's lots of context that could be provided around them. But 2 years before the 1988 federal election, which the Mulroney government won a majority in, they were in third place consistently for like a year and a half. They were in third place and they were 15 to 20 points behind the leading party. Sometimes that was the Liberals and sometimes that was the NDP. They won in two ways. There's two keys to their victory. One of which is there was an issue on the table that superseded all previous political disputes, free trade. So free trade made all the other stuff that people had been judging the government on irrelevant and said, now we have to choose about this. So it wasn't a referendum on them. It was a referendum on free trade. Second thing is they destroyed Turner. Right. In the old Alan Gregg terminology, they bombed the bridge. And so that was that formula. Feels to me like that is the formula. Corey?
That's always the formula, I think. Yeah. Like if you can't win an election on the basis of your record and your own popularity or your partisan affiliation or it's summation of all of those things, you've got to find a bigger issue. And we've seen other examples of that where sometimes it's an issue that's put on the table by the opposition, by the way. And, I look to the firing of 100,000 workers in 2014 as something that became a polarizing issue. Or if you go back before, it's, very oddly with John Tory, that religious schooling and, statements about, whether evolution is a theory or not. Like this is, it's almost cartoonish. It's almost cartoonish when you go back and think about it. But those are opposition, issues that got put on the electoral table right before a campaign that then ended up superseding the unpopularity of the incumbent. But there are options for this government to put other things on the table as well. But it's hard to see this tired and weary group of people in cabinet and within their organization as coming up with any bold thinking on anything. Like it seems to be incrementalism if necessary, but if we could do something less than that, we will. Like you're, bold is not exactly the term that I would use to describe the last 4 or 5 years of this government. Like, I think they came in with bold around things like carbon taxes and a number of other issues, but it's been a long time since we've seen something with that sort of clarity and poignancy coming out on the policy side.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I have a tendency, and I got to check myself on this. I have a tendency when I see this situation to focus entirely on the liberals and what they're doing wrong. But I think that we have to, at this point, concede that Polyev is doing some things right. And sure. that and that there is evidence that he is resonating personally with some members of the population, larger than may have been anticipated by some of us. And it isn't just unhappiness with the government. It's an interest in him and what he has and what he has to offer. And I am deeply skeptical. Somebody tell me I'm wrong. I'm deeply skeptical that people in the next election are going to care about the convoy and his shenanigans around the convoy. So when liberals say that to me, he was at the convoy and all that stuff, I'm just thinking, I don't know that anybody even remembers that or cares about that anymore.
Well, I would say there's pretty good data points that they don't. And one of them being like on any of this rearview mirror pandemic related stuff, like, look, it was an unfortunate time that was unpleasant for almost everyone who went through it, if not everyone who went through it. It's something that people want to not think about very much. They don't want to talk about it. It defined every conversation in all of our politics for almost 3 years, and nobody wants to go back. And, add in that elections are always more about the future than they are the past. So I think you already got a big knock against going back there to begin with, just on sort of baseline gravity of politics sort of things. And then I would put a multiplier on that in terms of people really don't want to go back to places and times where things were particularly divisive, whether it's within their own family or the politics generally, but it defied all of that. And you look at, you know, the Ford re-election is being a, you know, I think a great example of this. The guy who locked down the province repeatedly and made, you know, my friend Jenny and many other people quite upset with him, ended up all coming and voting for him. And almost without exception. And you know, when you look at those numbers, you know, the sort of PPC style voters, they either stayed home or they went and voted for Ford. And they weren't at 6%, they were at 2%. So it's I think all of that leads me to believe that the convoy stuff is just a wet firecracker. It's not gonna go anywhere. And I agree with you, David. I think they're doing a lot of things right. But one of them is like listening to the research around needing to file some of the sharp edges to soften his appeal, to make him look a little bit more normal and everyday, getting rid of the, you know, the 1770s militiaman theme of freedom with your fist and the one in the air on one side and a musket in the other. Like this is not, you know, a traditional Canadian campaign slogan, even on the right, even on the far right. But, you know, what is common sense. What is we're going to be the voice and the arms and legs of the middle class to try to get some things done for them, and to really ally yourself with that part of the electorate, and to show common cause and sympathy with them. And I think that when Polyev has been moving up, that's what he's been doing, whether it's around cost of living or interest rates or even things around sort of the excesses and entitlement in government, or even government competence. It's like, you should be able to get a passport in a timely way. You should be able to do this or that. But these are very, you know, man on the street, woman on the street interactions that they have with the government, saying the government has to do better. Like, so I agree. They're doing a bunch of things smart. And, you know, what you're seeing is that the numbers are continuing to march in that direction. And at the end of that road is oblivion for the Liberal Party if they're not careful.
So, as you may have heard, the strike that shut down British Columbia's ports is over, and the resulting backlogs are being cleared. Our sponsor, CN, announced last week that it is now current, meaning up to date, at the ports of Vancouver and Prince Rupert. Labour Minister Seamus O'Regan deserves the praise he's enjoyed for helping bringing about a settlement. Triangulating between the needs of business, the national economic interest, and the rights of workers is no cakewalk. But it's worth repeating, without assigning blame, the shutdown should never have happened in the first place. No single group should have the power to trigger or provoke what amounts to an economic nuclear option. Choking off two of the most important gates in Canada's supply chains at a time when the country is coping with continuing disruptions abroad was an act of severe self-harm, Which brings us to another development the federal government has made clear is in the offing, something that will profoundly disrupt the collective bargaining process. As part of its deal with one of the opposition parties for support in Parliament, the government intends to give organized labor the absolute right to shut down operations of any federally regulated company. CN is, of course, one of those companies. It continues to build respectful relationships with the unions representing its workers. Its guiding principle is to do what's right for the company and for its employees. But the foundation of that relationship is a balance. Unions can walk away from the bargaining table and call a strike. The company may then continue operations as best it can, but no employer wants to withstand such disruption. The whole system is meant to encourage a negotiated settlement. Now, though, the government proposes banning replacement workers. That will give one side a powerful tool and remove incentive to keep negotiating. In CN's case, being forced to shut down would instantly jam Canada's supply chains, which is just plain bad for every single Canadian. As I've said here before, just about everything moves by train at some point. The status quo works. The legislation contemplated in Ottawa would end that. It is in neither the interest of the economy nor of individual Canadians. Scott, maybe the reason they haven't gone after Poilievre is because they haven't established what their core critique of him is.
I think that's right. But you know when you'll find out that core critique? When you commission research and say, let's sit down and we're going to have an ad in the next 48 or the next 4 weeks. And then let's force ourselves to concentrate. And we'll let the research tell us what works. Like you guys are really zeroing on the convoy as though that's the only potential way to get under his armor. I think there's probably other routes. Like, I agree with you. It's too late on the convoy, or it feels like its political value beyond those who would already be hardcore against him is diminishing. It's one of the reasons I really wanted them. I wanted them to start going negative even before he became leader. Like, I thought, well, that was fresh in people's minds. While it was at a point where that issue was dividing opinion and driving opinion, I thought they should have labeled him and defined him and really made him wear it. And we know what he's like. He'll go G. Gordon Liddy and keep his hand over the candle. So, like, I would have forced him to keep his hand over the candle. And I just think that now what they've got to do is exactly what you say, David. They have to find out what the core critique is and then sort of say, what are the three, four most resonant levers? And, you know, fundamentally, there's a core science to this. You know, you say, well, I want him to be on the wrong side of issues that matter to people who will decide the election. And I want them to not only think that he doesn't share their view on that, but that then means that he doesn't share their worldview on a whole pile of things. So I can't trust him with the whole broad basket full of issues that we can't predict might land on his desk as prime minister, because he obviously doesn't guide by the same compass as me. And so, you know, it's equal parts issue and character, and what that issue tells you about character. You know, like, I think there are ways. You lock me in a room with some research and some money. I'd love the challenge of putting together, I would fucking relish the job of putting together the hammer on him. So I don't think that's beyond the ken of mortals, but they haven't shown any indication that they have a desire to do it. And by the way, I just want to come back to your earlier point about having trying to get an issue that supersedes it. You know, Corey was instinctively reaching towards provincial elections. The challenge, and I agree that it's, and I've brought this up in the past, I think it's a route that they should examine, but like, it doesn't just happen. Like, first of all, it happened in 1911, 1974, 1988. I stand to be corrected by historians, but it hasn't happened that often in Canada. Two of those examples are free trade. Right. Like, and two of those examples are, to borrow a point that Corey made, two of those examples hinged on proposals that came from the opposition. And so, you know, I just think, you know, they've got to look and see, like, what is their, they can't count on the idea that Poilievre will propose wage and price controls or religious school funding or fire 100,000 people on your way.
Deep historical reference for those not born in 1974. Look it up.
So I think they have to build toward that. So you have to start thinking now, well, what could be an issue that will overwhelm everything else. But that also matters to people. And, you know, they're not, it's easy to say, well, that's how to win the election, but those things aren't easy to come by. Sometimes you sort of bumble into them by accident. Mulroney didn't start the election cycle in 1988 thinking that he was going to make it a referendum on free trade. He over time discovered that in the weeks and months leading up to it, and then obviously during the campaign.
He was opposed to it in 84, was he not?
He was.
Yes, he was.
He was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But ran against anyway, the leadership. So, John Crosby was in favor of it.
Well, anyway, I just think I think they got to get firing on all those things, but most important of all, I think they have to show people that they're willing to change, that they get that they've got to actually move it, and they cannot get around the issue of the economy. Like they just can't.
Well, go ahead, Corey. I get the sense that you know there's this notion, and I've heard this suggested by some of my liberal friends out there that they are waiting for Poilievre to reveal his platform, and then that's going to provide the wedge that they need. Well, long gone are the days of putting out your platform a year in advance. And you know, Jenny Byrne's no dummy, as your audience knows, and Poilievre's no dummy, as those who've worked in Parliament with him will know. You don't have to do that. You don't have to put out a platform at all. In fact, you can have, you know, five priorities. You can keep it very thin and deny the Liberals the opportunity to grab the particulars of your climate change plan and use them to beat you to death with it. And we've seen that.
They don't can I just interrupt you, Corey? Just confirm something that I believe, which is the Conservatives could leave guns out of their platform entirely and not lose any votes.
Yeah, I think you could leave the platform out of the platform entirely, and right. and you're fine. Like, you know, in 2018, we didn't put out a platform, as you know, David. Like, I think day before the election, we cobbled something together. But you know, prior to that, the notion was always, well, we need to see your fully costed platform, and you know, maybe because we're a little bit too on the spectrum over here in the Conservative Party, we're like, oh yes, math. You asked us for math. Great. Let me get out my calculator. I'm going to tabulate all these columns, and then I'm going to hand to you the set of weapons to beat me to death with in a campaign. No, you don't have to do any of that fucking shit. Like, you know, you need to have a clear set of priorities, and you have to have clarity around your motive. But look, I want to do a
hang
little...
Hang on. Whoa. Can I, before you move off of that point, because I think that you got to be really careful of next war, last war. What you're saying is actually kind of a last war mentality, right? I think it's become conventional wisdom in political circles that you're better off without a platform, that you actually are better off on just running on a handful of priorities, that leaves you less vulnerable. And that's particularly sound policy and strategy for conservatives. I would just say, though, that creates vulnerabilities too. And what we haven't seen is someone do a really effective job of countering a campaign that's built around that. So one of the things that I would be doing in the corner of campaign headquarters, if I were the Liberals, would be thinking about how would you exploit that opportunity if that's the course that the Conservatives pick? And I'll give you a further thought on that. The mistake that people make when they're running against those kinds of campaigns is in the campaign itself, when obviously the incumbent is desperate and they're way down in the polls, they start inventing what the platform must actually be for the party that doesn't have a platform. And they spend time at the microphone saying, you can't elect these guys because they won't tell you what their real agenda is. They won't tell you what they think about. And the argument I would make is you want to start doing that well in advance of the campaign, because it gets discounted during the election campaign because you look desperate and people just think, well, you're only saying that to save your own bacon. So how do you lay track if that's where your opponent is going to go? If they're going to run a no policy, no platform campaign, how do you lay track to create a vulnerability around that? How do you turn that into an anchor, not a kite? And my argument is you got to do it shrewdly, and you have to do it well in advance of the writ dropping. And I think the reason that people think that's such an attractive option is that nobody has shown yet that actually that can be dismantled and proven to be a vulnerability. Someone will. I don't know if these guys will, but I'd be dedicating some energy to it because I'll bet a dollar that Pierre Polyev will run on a very thin platform for all these reasons. And I'd be thinking about how to use that against him.
Well, on the
Scott, all this positioning stuff, all this positioning stuff you talk about takes us back really though to a tactic, which is I look at the shift in Polyev's numbers and the shift in conservative numbers since they put that advertising campaign on the air. And I think back to what Brian Topp told me about the Alberta election and how they found out that nobody heard anything that they were doing in earned media. And the only messages they got were from paid. Media is over. Media is over. Yep. You got to get on the paid airwaves.
I agree with that strenuously. And it's a great time to be an old dinosaur because as that idea comes around, you find us waiting, sitting at the social club as old men. Hey, come on in. We'll teach you how to do it again.
Well, but on your point of you needing to actually get those narratives out earlier, if, say, in the 11th hour of an election campaign, you put an ad on the air saying, soldiers in the streets, you know, it's going to be martial law if Stephen Harper is elected, then that becomes the laugh track for this hour as 22 minutes as opposed to a poignant political message. So, you know, I agree with
you. I'll just take your shot and absorb it. I'll just take your shot and absorb it with all the positive energy that I can. And I will reinforce your point by saying that the more desperate your political situation is, the less effective your negative advertising is.
That's the argument I'm making. Yeah. So if you're going to try to hit that, like you got to go rope a dope in the first round, not in the last, right? Yeah. So,
all right, we got to move on.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, we got to move on. We got a clipping here from Christian Paslang at the CBC, which is based on an interview on The House. And boy, The House is a good program. If you people like public affairs, should listen to that program. Here's a segment from the article. Immigration Minister Mark Miller says the concern around the skyrocketing number of international students entering Canada is not just about housing, but Canadians' confidence in the integrity of the immigration system itself. Canada is on track to welcome around 900,000, let me repeat this, 900,000 international students this year, Miller said in an interview that aired Saturday on CBC's The House. That's more than at any point in Canada's history and roughly triple the number of students who entered the country a decade ago. Miller said there were a number of illegitimate actors who were trying to exploit the system, which was eventually having a negative effect on people trying to come to Canada for legitimate reasons. He said he would not get involved with naming and shaming, but said his focus was on some private colleges. Work would need to be done to tighten up the system, he said, to make sure institutions actually had space and suitable housing for people who were being admitted. Miller also said closer collaboration with provinces was key to solving the problem. And now, a quote from Polyev. We as conservatives will make sure that international students have homes, health care, and when they need it, jobs. When they want it, jobs. So that we can get back to a system that supports our universities, attracts the world's brightest people, helps the demographics of our country, but does not leave people living in squalor, conservative leader Pierre Polyev said. So, folks out there, hurly-burlyites, this is our clipping because I think our collective spidey sense is tingling about the political undercurrents around immigration. It has a very intuitive link to the housing crisis. It's also the case that when economic times are bad and people are hurting themselves, they become less supportive of immigration. Yet no political party is picking up this mantle. Corey, do you think, I mean, the Polyev quote's very telling. He does not want to blame immigration. Corey, do you think this political consensus can hold in the face of crumbling if public support evaporates?
Well, it's holding for now. I think over time, it's unlikely to. And I thought this was a good one for us to talk to because I was sort of gobsmacked that the first person to throw the anti-immigrant stone would be Miller and the Liberal Party. And I see no good politics in that. I think it's intellectually dishonest policy in a way, too. I would be naming and shaming if there's, you know, as I'm told, there are a handful of colleges that are going over their prescribed limits with impunity, and they're basically operating in the dark margins of this industry, which are, you know, are constitute kind of quasi fraud. I'll even point people towards, I think the Walrus did like a maybe 6 months ago, a long expose of this stuff. You know, where you've got a village of people putting together enough money to get one student and off to a Canadian college, and it's like a scam college with a bullshit degree, and they end up even more impoverished and in debt back in their home country, and it's essentially fraud. Not essentially, it is. It's fraudulent. But I think there's also a culpability here on the part of the federal government in terms of them saying, oh, well, we let in a whole bunch of foreign students, in this case, you know, three times as many as we were just a few years ago, and with no plan to house them, no plan. Like, these are areas where if the federal government wanted to actually engage on housing, they could do so. There's federal lands. They have the ability to contract and build federally. You know, why aren't we standing up housing for migrants? Why aren't we standing up housing for foreign students? If we're going to let them in, what's the plan to house them? The government federally could take that on, you know, in its entirety and actually get some results on it. But instead, it's like, well, you know, those immigrants, it's just such an unlikely message, especially for Miller, who I don't think that's like his you know, natural set of values or whatever, but it just, you know, I don't think he sees how that sounds. I don't think he sees the danger for the Liberal Party in terms of looking like they're finger pointing at immigrants at a time where Poilievre's support among immigrant communities across the country is going up. You know, you're going to push even more people into the loving embrace of the Conservative Party, and gosh, do I ever welcome them there. But I don't get why they would do it.
Such complicated issues, Scott. I mean, to me, the private colleges stuff, especially if they're bogus, doesn't seem complicated. But the university part of it seems very complicated, because my understanding of this is, you know, basically provincial governments are not funding universities at the level that they used to fund them at. And so they've made up that funding shortfall. I mean, they charge these foreign students an exorbitant amount of money to go to these universities.
And jack the fees year after year after year, because they realize it's an endless pump of cash.
But if they didn't have it, the tuition fees at any of our alma maters, University of Regina, Queens, any of that would be unaffordable for Canadians.
Just quickly on this, David, like the other part of this is provinces not only are not funding them to the same level, but I think it's less about that. It's that they've imposed freezes on fees. So the only fees that you can raise in many jurisdictions, including Ontario, is on foreign students. So that ends up being the piece that gets jacked, and the incentive is to bring in more foreign students. Now, look, overall, you know, the ethical dilemma on this is you're doing a brain drain on the developing world as opposed to anything else. But yeah, is it a net positive for Canada? Goddamn right it is. You know, we're basically siphoning off the smartest and most ambitious people from many of these places that, you know, could really use those folks where they are now. But you know, it's a huge benefit to Canada, but you know, the fraudulent stuff isn't, and you know, and there are you know, issues that could be solved, and the federal government could help solve them in terms of providing more funds to the university sector themselves, which they have in the past and have you know, stepped back from over time. So like, there are a lot of different policy fixes, but the politics on it, which is I think what we're more focused on, I think are very dangerous, and it's only a matter of time before that consensus around immigration gets, you know, chipped away at to the point of it being something quite dangerous.
Well, like, Scott, let me just follow up on that with you. Like, it's a weird question maybe, but if support for immigration declines, and, you know, he gets mentioned negatively on this show, so let me mention him positively. Frank Graves has tracked this more than anybody else I know over decades. And there are periods of time where Canadians have been quite against allowing a lot of people into the country. So if it becomes the consensus in Canada that we are, through a combination of citizenship, refugees, temporary foreign workers, and students, admitting too many people, and that's creating... meaning our own kids can't get houses, or our own kids can't get this or that, and there's no expression of that in the legitimate political parties in Canada, is this the opening that fucking Bernier's been looking for?
Well, we don't know. I don't want to hyperventilate. I don't want to go into overanalysis about the prospects that the immigration consensus will necessarily break up, but I thought that last week was weird. I thought that the twin interventions from Fraser, the former immigration minister, and Miller, the current immigration minister, I thought it was odd. And I to some degree, I know anecdote is not analysis, but to some degree, I think there's probably a real issue there on international students. Like I think I may have told you, David, off mic, you know, when my oldest son was trying to find a new place, he was willing to pay enough that he didn't think he'd have a lot of trouble, and he had a lot of trouble. And what happened was that even to rent a condo in the city of Toronto, in downtown Toronto, which is where he needed to be, he found that he was getting into bidding wars. And he was getting into bidding wars with international students. So what he was finding was that international students would show up and they would say to the agent, well, I'll pay the whole thing up front. I won't put first and last months. I'll put 12 months up front because they're being bankrolled by dad in, you know, in mainland China or India or wherever the heck they're coming from. And there's a bankroll there. And so over and over and over again, he'd say, Jesus Christ, I'm fucking getting clobbered here. And, you know, we ended up having to boost the down payment he would make and all that kind of stuff. So, but just as that's an odd story for me to tell about housing, I think this is an odd story for the federal government to tell about housing. Like I thought coming out of a cabinet retreat that they said was going to be principally about housing and bread and butter economics, I just thought it was strange.
Can I stop you?
Yeah.
Can I stop you? Just break your train of thought for a second. Have you ever seen a worse job of framing an event than that?
I don't understand what they're trying to
do. Have you ever seen a worse preconditioning effort on an event than that?
I didn't see any evidence of preconditioning. Oh, we're going to talk about housing.
No, there was evidence of preconditioning because, you know, some unnamed PMO source was out saying it's going to be about housing.
Right.
And
these guys come in.
And here are the experts that are going to come in and talk to us. But and one of those experts, I'll say with pride, listened last week and basically agreed with me, Scott. So there.
The point you were making that agreed with you about is something I've agreed with you about.
And also said that he basically fucking hates me. So, you know,
on the issue. We agree about you. He and I are in lockstep. Right.
God, there's so much agreement here. But look, at the end of that process, and I'll do another, reference to the hurly-burly. Like, I listened with great interest to Wilkinson's interview with you. I thought it was...
He's a fan of this show, by the way. That was really nice to hear from him. He's a fan of this show.
That was nice. And he appreciates my fashion choices around berets too. So it's good. But look, at the end, the most revealing thing in that whole interview, and if you only have, you know, 1 minute to listen to the last minute of that interview, because your final question really, I think, touched on the failure of that retreat and the failure of this government more broadly, where you basically asked, what's your ballot question? And what you got back was this rambling, muddled, run-on sentence of incoherence. And it's not that Wilkinson's an unintelligent person. He's a very intelligent person, and I think one of the more capable ministers in that government. However, when asked, like, okay, so what are you running on? What's the ballot choice next election? It was blah, 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 blah. You know, it sounded like, you know, Daffy Duck. It was, you know, it was terrible.
Can I just go back? I agree with that, obviously. But can I just go back to this issue of international students specifically and how it was used as an apparent sword last week? And it felt to me uncoordinated and probably less strategic than they thought. So I wasn't surprised to hear Sean Fraser
Miller
talk about it.
Miller effectively disagreed with Fraser.
They were having a public debate between two senior ministers of the cabinet. Were having in the newspaper, in the media, a disagreement on a fundamental policy plank that seemed improvised. It's like, you know, Miller out publicly musing about something, and then, you know, his public musings being slapped down by the housing minister who used to be the immigration minister. So, like, that's the kind of shit that, you know, you want to do behind closed doors.
Well, this is in part where I'm going. So, I mean, just from my perspective.
I'm going to stop interrupting you now. I'm just looking forward to tell you I'm going to stop interrupting you.
Just hit me with a cricket bat. See what happens. Do I continue to talk or do I leave? But they go in, they say, housing, 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 that's going to be the focus. Fraser comes out. Fraser was on the hurly-burly. just to keep self-referencing, right? And had raised this issue of international students, whatever it was, 3 months ago, right? So you know it was in the back of his mind. Those private colleges have been on his mind. When the fact that he spat that out at a microphone at the retreat, to me is a tell. And the tell is that they had nothing. Like they promoted this as being about this issue, but then they didn't have, and therefore we're going to do the following things. And I wasn't looking for a 5-point plan. I know that that wasn't going to emerge in the middle of the summer from a cabinet retreat, but at least some indication of, now, how do we want to carry this message forward? Like, what do we say the process is? What are the steps? What are our particular points of anxiety or the places that we're going to concentrate on, the notional goals we want to concentrate on? That wasn't laid out. That wasn't clear to cabinet ministers, obviously. Wasn't even clear, I don't think, to Fraser. So Fraser comes out, he goes back to the greatest hits, his needle drop on international students and private colleges. That's where I think it came from. So then you got Miller out on it, but you knew it wasn't coordinated because PMO was also, they kind of shied away in a couple of things. They're sort of like, well, hang on. Then you had stakeholders from the colleges and universities come out. And as far as this prime minister's office is concerned, stakeholder groups are the public, right? And so they get some pushback from stakeholder groups. The province of Quebec goes, stay the fuck out of our immigration policy, okay? Bugger off. And so you end up in this situation where it looks incoherent. Then Miller jumps in, right? And Opsiani. And so I think it's uncoordinated messaging on the issue that they themselves say is of greatest significance. So it means that they didn't have a message strategy, and that's not sharp. That's not wise. Second, as Corey points out, it's a strange thing to bring up because you're tattling on yourself. Right. If this is a failure, well, you've permitted the failure to arise, and or you have failed to compensate for this policy. And I don't know which is the right approach, to cap it or to create policies that allow us to continue to grow that that quota, but that you do things to provide for those folks. I also think it's an fucking odd place to start the housing discussion, because although it is important and it's clearly a threat in this sweater, it seems like a very peculiar, slightly off bullseye place for a lot of people who are like, I was wondering if my rent could be cheaper. I was hoping I could have my kids buy a house without a down payment of $400,000. So, you know, like, it just seemed an odd way into it. And so when you put it all together, you go, guys, like, if this is your principal political preoccupation, then, like, you got to do better. And I think Sean Fraser is wildly talented, as you know, and I think Mark Miller is a super smart guy. But I think what's really, what the whole
and
thing is...
And Wilkinson's a fantastic too, in my judgment, and yes, his portfolio, outstanding. But you know what? None of these people are being told what the fucking political strategy is.
That's my point. There's no
government without a political strategy. These people are out there swimming without an idea of where they're going.
They finally got the memo that housing is the problem and they can't say it's not a federal problem. And so they decide to say, yes, we're going to focus on it. But then nobody says, okay, so then what's the next sentence? And not the full answer, but what's the next sentence that carries us towards some sort of political positive outcome? And so people are improvising. And then you end up, now we have a national debate about international students that I don't think the government necessarily meant to provoke or is ready from a policy standpoint to manage.
Or 100%. Is politically going to benefit from. It's a weird one for them to put in the window. The other thing...
Speaking of waiting, we got to move on. We got to move on, because speaking of benefiting... Speaking of benefiting, there have been new developments in the Greenbelt issue since we last spoke as a group. The major ones are the resignation of the chief of staff to the housing minister and the referral for potential investigation from the OPP to the RCMP. The latter issue has allowed media to use the word criminality, and it's popping up in most stories, and that is a horrible, horrible word to be associated with you politically. My feeling, just to lead off this conversation, my feeling is that the Ford government's actually doing pretty well on the we need to build message. And if it were unencumbered by the specter of favoritism, the Green Belt might not be that much of an issue, the actual building on the Green Belt. I think that the housing issue is big enough. The Ford government is establishing its bona fides. I think most Ontarians don't care that much about that in the face of the problem. But the problem is, Ford is losing the argument on the process of how the land was allocated decisively, I think. And I think this could stick. It's always hard to judge what's going to stick to politicians these days, and especially Ford. He's got a unique kind of relationship with people. People have a sense of him. Maybe this won't damage him, but I think it's too on the nose for what people always kind of suspected about him. And I think this may stick. Scott, how would you help Ford get out of this mess?
Well, I think I don't think there's easy answers. I think that ultimately they're going to be victim to process. And that's what's really, there are two unpleasant things about last week for the Ford government. One is that the specific reference from the OPP to the RCMP provokes people into saying investigation, criminality, potential for criminal charges. And the RCMP quickly scrambled to issue a second statement sort of indicating, well, we're just doing an assessment. But as the former OPP commissioner, Chris Lewis, pointed out, the OPP probably didn't make the referral to the RCMP because they concluded there was nothing worth looking at. So you can intuit, but that's just speculation. But it creates new process. And you still got the ethics, the integrity commissioner, I should say. You still got that report hanging over you. You've got this investigation, potential investigation, assessment investigation. And I think that the Ford government is doing the best they can, which is, you know, to hammer away that the core issue is, look, we got to get stuff done. We got to get stuff built. And the problem is that that leaves them victim to the process. I don't think, for example, David, that they'll be beneficiaries of calling some independent inquiry to say, see, we have no worries about it. That's the last thing I would recommend at this point, to be honest with you, because that's just going to create another process and more demands for, you know, emails and DMs and PMs and so forth. So I think the truth of the matter is, I do think this is a serious issue. I think when cronyism and corruption start to get thrown around a government, they can stick to you. And if they do, then that's dangerous. And they may not kill you in the first pass, but they can hunt you down eventually. And I think of, I think of that Auberge that stuck around Chrétien for years, and people said it had no effect. But sponsorship, by the time sponsorship came a call in, you know, they had gone to the body enough that he dropped his hands and got hit in the face. So I think it's really dangerous for them. And I was puzzled by the decision to let go Amato. I was really puzzled by that because to me, just 2 days before they'd signaled like a prideful sort of story that the premier or himself personally intervened, that he wanted to stand by the guy and not let him have his job. Then on the eve of finding out the files being referred to the RCMP, he suddenly leaves. I don't know, man. That sure feels like smoke to me, but, you know, we'll have to see if there's any fire.
Corey, what do you think?
Not very much different than what I said last week. Like, I think the key for Ford on this and the Ford government is to keep the focus on building more housing and the need to do that. And I think the message is, look, we were elected on a platform of getting it done, of getting housing built, getting transit built, getting highways built, getting hospitals and long-term care built. And we're going to do that. And look, not everyone's going to like every decision or every process or lack of consultation here or arbitrary decision-making over there. But that's how you actually get shit done quickly. And at the end of the day, if we have to choose between everyone being happy with every decision and actually honoring the larger theme of what your election platform was based on, you're better to go with the latter. You're better to honor that larger election commitment of getting shit done. And so, like, I think that's the path out. You know, look, the X factor in all of this is if there's a police investigation, do they find anything of merit? And if they do, then you've got a whole world of trouble. But if they don't, then, you know, you move on. And yeah, I agree with you that these things are cumulative over time. But I think if Ford has one superpower, it's the ability to course correct with minimal damage. And we've seen that time and time again with him. And it harkens to, I think, the other politician, I'd say, who shared that same superpower to the same level was Ralph Klein. You know, where you can just say, oh, geez, you know, shouldn't have said that, shouldn't have done that, not doing that anymore. And able to sort of sidestep it to a degree that most politicians are unable to.
But he would, just to follow up a bit, he would change, though. He would drop policies. Like, he would change when he ran into pushback. He wouldn't plow through and say, well, I'm sorry I did that, but fuck it, I did it. He would change it.
Yeah, well, you can change things on a go-forward basis, but like, and you know, we'll see what happens with these greenbelt lands over time. Like, there's basically a foot race to develop, and if some people don't develop, then the land goes back into the greenbelt. And I would say that's not a bad outcome from a politics standpoint. If some people don't cross that threshold to lose those changes, because I think it then points to the motive actually being correct and being around housing. So, you know, we'll see what happens. Like, I think there are too many cards left to be revealed on the table to know exactly where everything's going on these things. But, you know, it's my absolute belief that in terms of the premier, like, his motive is, in my view, beyond question. And the thought that there's any chicanery, you know, involving him, I would say that the probability is zero. So, you know, I think that...
But true as that might be, you can't expect people to believe that, right? Because they don't know him the way you know him, right? So they just can go by what they see, and it looks suspicious. Here's what I think Ford could get away with right now. I think Ford could get away with saying, you know, I really wasn't on top of this process the way I should have been, and it looks like it wasn't proper. We do need to build, and we need to build on these greenbelt lands right away. So let's redo this process really quickly. Put some people together that meet some smell test, and do the land allocations again. And then I think, you know, I think the greenbelt fight's kind of won.
Yeah, well, like I think on developing parts of the greenbelt, the public is there, you know, at least in all the research I've seen. But where they're not there is around some of the process stuff. You're right. But, you know, I think he's said a version of that message already in terms of accepting most of the, all but one of the recommendations from the AG.
But it's, you know, just the one about reversing the process.
Redoing it all, but it's easily said and very difficult to do, because, you know, you've now have changes in values of this land, and, you know, and then everything's opened up, and you've got something where you're only talking about the greenbelt for the next 2 years, maybe three. And I don't think talking about the greenbelt is where the votes and where the public interest is. I think building housing is where the votes and the public interest is. And you want to get off the greenbelt and onto that. And the way to do that is to not, you know, open an inquiry or open a new process or, you know, redo the decision from square one, because I think that is a guarantee that you only talk about the greenbelt. And that's, you know, in my view, the wrong thing to do.
I would add two quick things. One, I think the opposition have been less effective than they should be.
They're all conflicted.
$8.3 billion looks like it's been made available in terms of that. That's the interest that's been put on the table. I would be saying $8.3 billion.
The sponsorship program is absolute chump change compared to that. Absolute chump change. Well, it's barely beer and popcorn money, for Christ.
Yeah.
Oh,
boy.
Ooh. Yeah, let's go there.
Come on, I had to take soldiers in the streets today.
Yeah, oh, fuck, yeah. I was there too. Wait a minute, so I should get a double dose of shit?
Hey, let's get rid of the notwithstanding clause
where we're at. I still think that's the right idea.
Every Hail Mary in there all at once.
But the opposition should be pounding away on
$8.3 billion. Nobody will ever say I quit, Corey.
They should be stapling $8.3 billion to the government. The second thing is, and this is the if, but if there are investigations, either through the Integrity Commissioner or the RCMP or both, that demonstrate the people in and around Ford made money off of this stuff, then that, I think, will diminish his ability to Ralph Klein this thing away. Because at that point, then you get into this cronyism, corruption, and that gets very dangerous territory politically and sort of doing the aw shucks thing. And so, as difficult as, you know, the reason he's not reversing the process is A, he doesn't want to reverse the process, and B, reversing the process will open you up presumably to a ton of litigation from those developers who, you know, presumably are sitting on a war chest of $8.3 billion with which they can pay expensive lawyers. So they probably don't want to go down that path, but they may be forced to at some point.
Well, all right. I think there's a lot more cards to be played, including on the policy side around this stuff. Like, the, you know, I do encourage everyone to listen to that Hurly Burly with Jennifer Keesmaat, where she wears the critic of the Ford government and then, you know, quickly changes into her developer hat and basically confirms every assertion he's made around the problems in development. But look, there are challenges with the developers for sure. You know, where the value that's accrued in the market by changing the designation of land is more important than actually building housing, and that you get people who, you know, get permission to build, and then they either flip that land or they sit on it and wait for it to accrue an even greater value, and they do everything except build the fucking homes that they were, you know, that the government expects them to. And so I think there's a lot of things that can be done that the development community is probably not going to universally applaud, but I think the public will. Because they are part of the opportunity in terms of solving the housing problem, and they're part of the fucking problem too. And you know, you got to be using a series of both carrots and sticks, I think, throughout this system, whether it's municipalities or developers, if you want to get anything done.
All right. Well, that was a great insight into the going forward political strategy. Thanks, Corey. It was really interesting. All right, Mr. Pinsent, can you bring this rollicking session to some sort of respectable conclusion, please?
Ladies and gentlemen, please return to your seats. The Hey Yous are about to begin.
All right, who's got a Hey You?
I got one.
Here you go.
I'll jump out. My Hey You is to David and my old boss, Paul Martin, turns 85 today, so we want to wish Mr. Martin a happy birthday. And I just want to say, take a look at what this guy was all about at the time. At the fucking time, New Deal for cities, a deal on healthcare, right? A Kelowna Accord to deal with basic services for Indigenous people and Indigenous reconciliation. Obviously, dealing with the National Child Care Program, right? On and on and on. He's talking about climate. Obviously, using a surplus to finance, government services, but also to shove the Federation in a direction he wanted it to go. I just think you look at those things, he was right. He was right. He was right. He was right. Happy birthday.
Excellent. Love it. Corey, what do you got?
Bill Blair.
Really?
Hey, you, Bill Blair. We saw, actually, I think it's in the media this morning, that a memo to the RCMP, months old, about it's time to apologize and accept responsibility for the terrible situation that occurred in Nova Scotia with the mass shooting there, and the incompetence demonstrated by the RCMP again and again and again throughout that terrible night and the next day. And how none of that's happened. And so, you know, when we were talking cabinet shuffle, I put out there that Bill Blair was the absolute embodiment of a past its prime government and put in a position in a role where he never should be. You know, you never want to have cops in charge of the cops or generals in charge of defense, or, you know, whenever you get into that situation, it generally goes badly for you. But this past its prime, weak cabinet minister, now has an opportunity to actually step up and do something correct here. So he's in charge of the department, in charge of the RCMP, in, at a policy basis in an appropriate way, and get them to go out and fucking apologize already. So, hey, you Bill Blair, time to prove me wrong and go and do your fucking job.
There you go. Here you go. All right, my hey you goes out to Liberal leadership candidate Bonnie Crombie, the mayor of Mississauga. This greenbelt issue is, you have to assume, the biggest vulnerability the Ford government will face in this term. It is key to changing liberal and conservative political fortunes. You are ideally suited as the mayor of Mississauga, as somebody that's responsible for building houses, as somebody that's on the edge of the greenbelt, to take a big stick to Ford on this and lead the fight against him. You get media attention. Ford responds to what you say. This is your moment, and it's your moment to do this for the Liberal Party. So step up and lead the charge on the Greenbelt. Hey, you. All right, that's our show for today. I'd like to thank everybody who watched or listened. Thank you, all you accursed out there. I'd like to thank Corey and Scott for showing up, and no thanks to Jordan for not showing up. And I'd like to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, and our sponsor, CN Rail. See you next week, and in the meantime, take care of yourselves.